distance in your eyes. Oh no, I've said too much. I said it up. Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. My name is Ethan Clow and I am the historian of Radio Free Thinker. And joining us as always, we have Daniel.
Hello.
Rob.
This is Rob. I'm a psychologist and magician.
And of course, Don.
Hello, I'm Don, resident philosopher and political science expert.
And did anything happen on this day in history, Don?
You know, it's interesting. Today is a birthday for the entire universe. Johann Kepler calculated that the Earth was created on April 27, 3992 BC. Happy birthday, universe.
How did he come
that
to
was
this
pretty good sound.
Decision?
Well, Kepler, being a product of his society, was originally a theology student. He had to be in order to go to the higher education, and part of his work was to go through the Bible and calculate the ages of people and the birth date. He wasn't the first one to come up with it, but it's very interesting the fact that this person who calculated, who was a creationist, a young Earth creationist no less, is also one of the people who set down one of the foundation principles of astronomy and the universe and help us be a modern society.
Well, just goes to show you that anyone can contribute to the academia of science, even a creationist.
Well, of course, and he got that way by accepting reality over his own beliefs. I mean, he was originally one of these people who believed in all the jiggery-pokery of astrology and on all that, and it just didn't match with the data. And he used his reason to say, okay, data comes first, wacky ideas
come second.
Wasn't
he off by billions of years?
No, that was his work on the universe, but later on when he discovered the three laws of motion.
Good for him.
I think it might have been a better estimate than previous ones.
True.
Well, that's pretty fascinating, but right now we're going to go to Daniel, who's going to talk a little bit about education reform.
Yes, with the provincial election about to start, education is usually on everyone's mind, but with the economy and everything, not quite so much this time. But there are still ads with sad pictures of children telling you that you should vote for better education and all that stuff.
What exactly do they mean by better education?
They're generally quite vague.
Is there like a little ballot that says better education on the voting thing?
Or? Support the sad children.
Generally, they need more money and bigger or smaller class sizes, which I will get to soon. But education policy is a field that generally has quite little critical analysis of it. You get like a lot of interested groups like parents and teachers who, without truly thinking about it, like, I mean, it's your children. You want them to have the best education possible. So anyone offering you, like, an idea for how to do that, you're going to believe them. And generally, there's not a whole lot of critical analysis.
So is this the sort of thing that comes up at PTA meetings, or...?
Yeah, it can. Or just, like, in general, when people are asking the government for better education, generally it falls into one of two things. They want more money or they want smaller class sizes. And smaller class sizes require more money. But so I'm going to look at those two and one other myth about education to see whether the evidence actually supports those two ideas. The first one I'm looking at is the money myth. In the U.S., education spending, which has been adjusted for inflation, has gone from $1,214 per student in 1945 to almost $9,000 in 2001, and education has improved less than 2%. Obviously, over that long of a period of time, there's some other things that could be in play, but it does give you like a general idea that spending tons more isn't producing way better outcomes. In Canada, in Nova Scotia from 1997 to 2004, there was a 20% increase in spending and less students. So that meant a huge increase in per student spending, and student performance went down.
Oh, geez. So why do people think spending money and throwing money at the education system is going to make it better?
It seems logical. If your house is broken, you generally spend money to fix it. But what the problem is you have a monopoly on education, mostly by the government. So what you're doing is when you're spending more money, it largely goes to bureaucrats. And
I don't know. I would argue with you on that. I mean, first of all, you used the stats 1945, right?
Yeah.
As the original one. And you have to realize that in between that time, we had the baby boomer generation. So a lot of money would be spent into infrastructure. A lot of money, too. I mean, back in 45, you didn't have to have classroom-equipped labs. You didn't have to have the same kind of safety equipment in the chemistry labs and all that. And a lot of that money could go for that.
Which is why I have a better study by Eric Hanushek of Stanford University. He looked at 163 studies by social scientists and found only 27 of 163 showed a correlation between per student spending and increased like academic efforts or effects.
Is this coming from the fact that, you know, you throw money at the system, but you're not really telling them what to use it for?
That can definitely be part of it. But also, this is more of to go with the class size, which is largely what more money is spent on, hiring more teachers and lowering class size. So I'll talk about this after. But basically what this does show is that, at least in the way politicians generally do it, more money to the system is not increasing results. Only 27 of the 163 studies showed like any improvement, and generally it was quite small. And so this myth continues on despite little evidence. As for the class size one, it seems obvious, like more personalized attention from teachers should mean that like each student, especially the like ones that are having more trouble, will do better.
It seems reasonable.
It does, but once again, looking at evidence, it generally isn't. Students from kindergarten to grade 3 in Tennessee were part of the STAR Project, as they called it. And basically, they randomly put them into a small class size stream, a normal class size stream, which is about 24 students, which is about what BC is right now, and a normal size with a teacher aide as well as a teacher. The normal and teacher aide scores were the exact same. The small class side had a small initial improvement, but they didn't get better every year. So Eric Hanushek, who also looked at this one, he figures it's because parents who were more active in their students' education kind of got them into the smaller class size one by like sort of getting angry at officials and stuff. It worked. So that's how I got into the school I got into. but doing that, that's why they had an initial benefit, but each subsequent year there was no improvement at them, which goes to show you'd think if smaller class sizes had much of an improvement every year, they'd be doing better. It wouldn't just be a one-time thing. But also along this thing, if you're going to decrease class sizes from about 24 to about 18, which is what they did in that study, it's a like 30% increase in teachers and therefore like about a 30% increase in spending, which also means you have to go farther into the labor pool and find teachers that aren't as good.
I was about to ask if this might be a quality versus quantity issue. I mean, getting more teachers might be all well and good if the teachers are good. I was wondering if you had anything about hiring practices for teachers when in these...
That's sort of what my last myth is about.
Okay.
And also, when you're dealing with class sizes, decreasing by 5 or 6 students, I don't think that would make a huge difference. Now, if you decrease by like 50%, and assuming you had, you know, good teachers, that would probably have a significant impact. But by just decreasing 5 or 6 students, we're not getting anywhere.
We're kind of going a little over time on this, so I'll just quickly wrap up the last one. The current agreements for teachers is that you are considered a better teacher and therefore get more money if you take more teacher training or you have like a master's degree or you have a certain amount of years teaching. And so all these things, they were looked at through 171 scientific studies, or this is for teacher education. Only 9 found a positive correlation and 7 found a negative correlation. So generally, that these teacher education has little effect on on the student outcome of those teachers, as well as teacher experience. Of the 270 studies looked at, only 29 found a statistically positive link, and also it was generally more the first like 2 or 3 years a teacher would improve to about their peak, because they were getting more comfortable in classrooms. But by the end of the time there, too, like as they were like teaching for 20 years, generally their performance got worse because teachers have almost absolute job security after like 20 years. So
I can definitely attest personally that I have had some tenured profs here at UBC that have been some of the worst teachers I've ever had in my life.
No names now.
Of course, the flip side is I've had quite a number who are quite good as too. The point being is you get a bit of both. Are you saying that experience leads to incompetence?
Well, it can lead to laziness if you have job security.
It can lead to laziness. But I mean, I think the idea behind this last point is that the amount of time you spent teaching has no bearing on how good a teacher you are.
Mm-hmm. After the first few years. And just to quickly wrap it up, this won't be completely dismal. Here's how we can make the like teaching climate better.
Maybe we should save that for after the commercial.
Yeah, maybe we'll quickly go to commercial and then come back.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies. It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce. It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems. Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply. Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
And we're back to quickly wrap this up. I'm going to quickly talk about how to improve education and spend less money. To put it quite simply, you want to give parents and students more choice. And by doing this, you want to remove the government monopoly on producing education. Not necessarily on paying for education, but on producing it. And this means that you want to slowly increase the number of private schools that are allowed by putting people into voucher programs where they get a certain amount of money put towards any school. One country that did this, which you think is the last country in the world to do this, because a lot of people think this is some crazy right-wing idea, is socialist Sweden. And they started to offer vouchers with enormous success. Parents loved them, students loved them, even the teachers' unions, who initially were completely against them, thinking that it was going to, like, ruin their grip on education, now loves them. And when properly studied, they have produced a 6 to 11% increase in anything from reading to math scores, and generally cost less money than supplying it by the government themselves. Now, I think Don wants to argue with me.
Well, first of all,
itching to say something.
I'm going to start off with a comment about Sweden. One thing that's different about Sweden and other nations is it's a very small, homogeneous country that has a very well-developed social system to begin with.
And is also awesome.
Yes. Praise be to IKEA. but going on there, okay. First of all, I would disagree with the fact that they actually spend more money on their students. I mean, first of all, you have to factor in the fact that private schools, whoever pays for them, are private schools, and they're there to make a profit. So however inexpensive they might make things, and whatever the sacrifices they might make for students, their profit isn't going to be sacrificed. And that's always an added extra cost into it. A lot of these costs go into the administration of their schools. Okay, everyone complains about bureaucracy, but still, there's a heck of a lot of bureaucracy involved in the administration of private-type schools. Among them, which you can't avoid, are things like insurance, things like marketing. And marketing is a big, important part. We want to have students going to schools that are good for them, and not just because they have great advertising. And I think a lot of the problems, the experiences that they've had in England with this, England has become quite a disaster with what's happened. You get marginalization, fragmentation, you get a two-tiered education system. It's basically everything we dislike about the American medical system is what Daniel wants to bring to our education system.
Okay, well, this is a great debate for perhaps another show. We got to go on to our next topic, which Rob is going to tell us all about.
Yeah, speaking of international matters, the swine flu has been spreading around in global pandemic proportions, or at least that's what the media would have you believe. We encourage you to look at reports from the WHO and critically evaluate whether you are actually in danger of the swine flu.
Or if you're not, more in danger of catching the normal influenza and dying from that.
This is true. In fact, as far as global pandemics go, AIDS is by far more deadly and more widespread. We have some statistics here that Don's showing me that the number of infected which are confirmed for swine flu, 273. Bird flu, 257. The Asian flu, 1 to 4 million globally. And the number of dead confirmed for swine flu, 26, all in Mexico. Save for bird flu, 421. Even SARS, 775. So take a look at how terrifying the swine flu really is in the grand scheme of things.
It has just started, though, to be fair.
And Rob, I mean, really, I'm really worried about it. What kind of things can I do to protect myself from something
wash
like
your
this?
Hands.
Wash your hands, definitely.
Or wear one of those little mask things. That will definitely stop it.
Oh, I wish I'd stopped that.
We're not sure that those things work. Those, washing your hands does work.
Those more stop you spreading it to other people than you getting it yourself.
Well, actually, yeah, those masks are absolutely pretty much worthless, just so you know.
Well, following on from last week when we talked about naturopathy and their treatments and how they have new legislation allowing them to basically prescribe real medicines, and in the context of the swine flu, if you are considering going for some alternative treatments or your friends or family are, we have a couple of points here for you to think about, some questions to ask when you want to consider any treatment or therapy, really. The number one question you should be asking, of course, is does it work? Does it have a reasonable mechanism of how it could work?
So not just go by that you just really, really want it to work, so that's why you take it?
It has to have some kind of basis in virology or bacteriology or something that has been scientifically studied. That's another point. Has research about the treatment been published in peer-reviewed medical journals? Has it been based on double-blind randomized trials of its efficacy when compared to, say, placebo or other existing treatments? These are all questions you should be asking about any treatment you want to try.
Bro, could you just really quickly tell us a bit about double-blind studies for people who don't know? Why is that so important?
The idea behind a double-blind study is to get out any bias that could be affecting how efficacious the patient or the doctor thinks the treatment is. If the doctor comes in and tells them, here, I'm going to give you a treatment, it's the real treatment rather than the placebo, and it's definitely going to work, that might make the patient feel better when, in fact, they're still suffering some of the symptoms. But the same thing for the doctor. We don't want the doctor to influence the patient in this way, so we set up double-blind trials where neither the doctor nor the patient knows whether they're getting the real treatment. And randomized trials are so that you can apply statistics to it later.
I think the methodology, too, is important. Above and beyond the double blind is that when you're doing these studies, you have to take into consideration placebo effects. Placebo effects are real, and they really happen. I was just listening to a podcast the other day that was making the comment that if you have a blue pill, blue, the color blue, seems to be a calming color. So if you have your medication is one blue pill and the other one's a red pill, that in itself can make a difference. And a lot of these scientific studies, the methodology involved compensates for this. We know placebo effects exist, and they take that into consideration when they design it, as opposed to a lot of other experiments that aren't really experiments by people who just say, this works.
So question number one, does it work? Question number two, who is promoting it and how is it being promoted? Are the people promoting it reputable? Are they scientists? Are they
medical doctors?
Medical doctors? Are they naturopathic doctors? Are they politicians? Why are they interested in promoting a particular treatment? Are they just interested in helping out? Are they interested in making a lot of money? Both? Something else? As far as how it's promoted, is it being promoted as a traditional remedy, or is it promoted as something that's worked for thousands of years? Or this is really popular with a lot of naturopathic treatments. Is it being promoted by anecdotal evidence? Is it being promoted by people posting on the website of whatever treatment is saying, it worked for me, try blah, 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 blah. You know?
I love that drug.
Try Dametol.
You know, I'm sorry. When you were talking about who's promoting it, I can't help but think that you're just a sellout to one of the big pharmaceutical corporations. I mean, my mom tells me that, you know, if you take a little willow bark and you boil it up, that can cure so many things, bad breath or whatever, right? And I mean,
speaking of willow bark and how it can cure a lot of things, that actually has been turned into a real medicine known as aspirin. So this is just the thing, you know, like a lot of the old joke goes about what do you call natural medicines that work? Medicines. But another thing to look out for is if something's being promoted by really cool-sounding statistics. I was reading the other day in this SIAM Mind, Scientific American Mind, had an article about how people misunderstand statistics and probability when they're being used to promote medical treatments. And they gave the example of, I think it was Lipitor, a heart disease medication, which said that it had a 100% decrease in risk of heart disease.
100%. That's pretty impressive.
Or I may be completely misremembering, but it was a very impressive percentage. And when you actually looked at the data, it was sort of like, you know, 2 out of 10,000 people are at risk for this kind of disease, and taking this medication reduced it to 1. So I guess it reduced it by 50%, you know, 50% or 100% from 1 to 2.
Well, again, that just tells you statistics, depending on how you manipulate them, can mean many different things.
Which is a good reason why you want the medicine you take to go through several different studies and experiments before you know.
Yeah, never trust the box and never trust what other people say about it. Trust science. Lots and lots of science, not just one science.
one science.
Just one science. Actually, there's a good resource for this sort of talk, sciencebasedmedicine.org. I encourage you to look at that. Look up. They have a good database of articles and studies of various different treatments. So that's who is promoting it and how. And the third question, what's the harm? What are the side effects of taking this treatment? Not just reputable treatments, but treatments that you think might not have any side effects if you're already a skeptic. You know, like various supplements, mineral supplements.
Well, if you take too many of them, you might get heavy metal poisoning. So you have to be on the lookout for that sort of thing. Also, think about the other kind of side effect of taking maybe not so scientifically supported treatment. What's the harm in doing that and delaying a treatment that would be considered more efficacious? I mean, there's cases of people going and taking supplements or homeopathic remedies instead of going in for chemotherapy when they have leukemia.
Well, the situation like that really makes you wonder about the ethical mentality of the person advising this type of behavior. For example, people who advise others to not get vaccinated because of some mommy instinct that it might cause autism.
Yeah, there's a big movement going on right now in the States and the UK and, you know, coming up to Canada maybe, that vaccinations cause autism through some sort of mercury that's being left in the vaccination fluid.
Which they've taken out of the vaccination.
Several years ago, too. Yes. It's a very old and...
But I think it's even funnier, even on the face of it. Let's assume, and it's not true, but even if you assumed that there was a chance of you getting autism. I think they have a thing, it's like 1 in 10,000 people can get autism from this. But before they had the vaccination, it was like 1 in 100 kids died from these vaccinated diseases.
Yeah, polio was an epidemic. So it is a bit about, I guess risk management would be a way of saying it. Like, you've all heard the expression, is the cure better than disease? Is if you have cancer and you're going through chemotherapy, it might actually make your living conditions quite worse.
Yeah, so that's what's the harm, and actually a really good resource for finding out what the harm might be in taking various treatments, whatstheharm.net. Have a check out on that. And
But you still haven't answered my question. I'm all worried about this swine flu, and you've told me a lot of information, but what can I do to protect myself? Should I go out and get this homeopathic medicine? Is that the best thing for me?
Well, here's a thing from Skeptic. Daniel, you can read that out.
On www.skeptic.org. The things more likely to save you from swine flu than homeopathy. Number one, and this is a really good one if you can afford it, a private island.
you'll never get swine flu.
Can I get a prescription for that? Is that covered by BC Health?
Probably not. Number two, a gas mask. It's useful as well. Number three, this one's really good, real medicine.
Oh,
I've heard of that. I've heard of
aliens is number four. I'm not sure.
Oh, no, I'm waiting for them. They're going to solve all our problems.
Maybe they take you from the planet. I'm not sure. Mace to keep others away.
You can substitute that for other things, I think.
Or like a shotgun. Jesus, note, only if you're in a Stephen King novel. Superman, not...
He's coming to save the day!
And your own immune system.
Cool.
I like my immune system.
I feel safer already.
All right, we'll go to station ID.
You people feel like making some noise tonight!
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, Cookie Monster's favorite radio station.
Good night, Chicago! Brutal!
So, welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. We're almost out of time, and we encourage you to email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, read our blog at ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com, and follow us on Twitter at...
CITRRFT. And I a couple days ago went in and fixed up our Twitter feed. We're now following some luminaries in the skeptic world, and we have a picture, and basically the Twitter feed doesn't suck anymore.
Doesn't suck, people.
And speaking of Twitter, our quote from the day comes from one of those Twitter feeds from richarddawkins.com. This is from Denis Diderot, 1774. The philosopher has never killed any priests, whereas the priest has killed a great many philosophers. Which maybe is why I'm so nervous of priests.
Well, that's very good. So I'll be saying goodbye from Radio Free Thinker. This is Ethan Clow saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, brains on.
This is Daniel saying goodbye.
And this is Rob saying good luck, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Ciao. Bye.
On May 12, 2009, British Columbians will again be voting on whether to adopt the new voting system recommended by the BC Citizens Assembly on Electoral Reform, BCSTV. BCSTV is a more representative system in which elected representatives accurately